Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, February 3rd, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. All video evidence suggests that Alex Preti was legally carrying a firearm when he was shot and killed by federal immigration agents in Minnesota. And in the aftermath of that incident, the usual politics around gun ownership and Second Amendment rights has been a bit scrambled, frankly. A lot of liberals, folks on the left, pointing out that Preti was legally carrying a firearm. On the right, many commentators and, frankly, government officials saying he shouldn't have been carrying a firearm, as is his right. And so today on the show, we're going to take a look at whether this flashpoint means there's something changing in the American gun debate. Are liberals, usually resistant to gun ownership, more open to the idea? Are conservatives changing their tune? And of course, we want to hear from you. Have your views on gun ownership changed in the past 10 years or so? Why or why not? And if you're someone who's maybe considering buying a firearm for the first time or getting rid of your firearm, we would be really interested to hear your story and your rationale. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org.
Yeah, again, the number is 888-477-9499. The email, studio2@whyy.org. Would love to hear from folks who maybe have become gun curious in recent years. Love to hear your thoughts. And now we have a trio of news stories.
Start us off, Cherry.
Yeah, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro is giving his budget address this hour. His proposal revolves around affordability, with a particular focus on housing infrastructure and clearing zoning red tape. Nice write-up by the Philadelphia Inquirer previewing the governor's $53.2 billion budget proposal. This is his fourth time pitching to lawmakers, and Shapiro is also expected to focus on energy prices. He is expected to reintroduce his plan to increase renewable energy production and a new Pennsylvania-specific cap and trade carbon program. He'll also lay out plans to generate new revenue to fill a nearly $5 billion structural deficit in the budget. His new ideas are not necessarily
new. Not new at all, yes.
No, we're talking about
reheated ideas.
Legalized cannabis, of course, he wants that. And, of course, skills games. And if your eyes may be glazing over a little bit when I say the word budget, it's because, you know, last year's budget got done less than 3 months ago. And here we are again talking about the budget, because last budget, there was an impasse of more than 135 days.
Yeah.
They were deadlocked for so long, forcing schools, counties, and nonprofits to take out loans to stay afloat. But the good news is this is an election year, so there's motivation by all parties to get this thing done and done quickly.
And of course, you can't separate all of this when it comes to Josh Shapiro from the national politics.
Of course.
From the idea that this could be the last budget before he really gets into maybe.
And that's the motivation.
Maybe the presidential picture. And of course, he's up for re-election as well. You just noted that, right? So he's got his own election to worry about here in Pennsylvania as he's running again for governor. So we'll see how that affects all of this. But like, national politics are swirling around this, and we'll swirl around this as long as Shapiro's the one doing the negotiating, right?
For sure. And by the way, he's been making the rounds. He has
his new
memoir out. So a lot of talking points, making headlines, you know, speaking against ICE, all sorts of things. So you're seeing his name in lights right now.
Yeah, I think you're going to keep seeing his name.
Yeah, for sure.
In lights for a while. Story number two. A federal appeals court has revived a lawsuit against the school district of Philadelphia that challenges its admissions policy for selective high schools. Mm. So this is all about how students are selected essentially for the big academic magnet schools in Philadelphia. You might have heard of some, Central, Masterman, etc. For years, the criteria to get into these schools is based on grades and test scores and behavior. And then the schools themselves, sometimes the principals, got to pick among the group of students who qualified based on those criteria. Well, about 5 years ago, the district made a huge change, and it took away individual school discretion. So students who qualify now go through a computerized lottery system, and this is the crucial part, students from certain underrepresented zip codes get preference in the randomized lottery process. Now, at the time, this is also very crucial, school officials said that this change was intended, among other things, to make the system more equitable. Black and Hispanic students have long been underrepresented at some of these top schools. Well, a group of parents sued, saying this new policy was discriminatory. Their case was tossed out. Now, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals says the case should not have been tossed, and it could proceed to trial, which could eventually overturn this new admissions system. And why did the appeals court do this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they said that there were statements on the record from school officials at the time of the change saying that it was intended to alter the racial makeup of the schools and thus could be unconstitutional. Not saying it is, saying it could be.
It could be. Yeah, the school district argued that the lottery preferences were based on geography, but not race. But now it'll be up to a judge or possibly a jury, a civil jury, to look at the evidence and decide whether race was, in fact, a factor. And not surprised at all about the shift, because if you rewind back to about 5-6 years ago, yep. 2020, post George Floyd, the whole attitude was very different. And politics are now very different, right?
And the case law was different back then.
Case
too.
Law was different. And now anything that looks like diversity, equity, or inclusion, aka DEI, is getting challenged and finding support in the courts because the precedent has shifted.
Now, the Supreme Court made a huge shift on
made
this.
Made a huge shift. So, by the way, the plaintiff parents in this case are represented by lawyers from America First. That's an organization formed by Stephen Miller, who is a top aide to President Donald Trump. And they have called this decision by the court, opening up for a trial, a major victory. And so I'm not surprised to see these types of challenges.
No, no.
But I do remember people were so upset because they felt like it was the principal preferences led to underrepresentation,
yes,
of certain groups. So they were hoping to correct that. And now this correction seems to have crossed some legal lines, or possibly.
Right.
We don't know.
And
we don't
one
know.
Of the big questions moving forward, let's say that this does eventually get tossed. And I don't mm-hmm. know that it will, but let's
mm-hmm.
say it does.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just revive the same policy, but just not say
yeah.
what you're intending to do? Because mm-hmm. that seems to be the tripwire here, mm-hmm. which is that school officials at the time, I don't think any of them, by the mm-hmm. way, are still with the district, said that racial equity was part of the goal. But the policy itself doesn't say anything about
no.
race. It just
does zip codes.
It just does the zip code thing. So I would imagine moving forward, whether it's Philadelphia or any other type of school system, they could make an end run around this by just never saying that on the
race.
Record.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. But at the time, people were openly saying these things. I mean, you
know. Because it was a totally different time.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Times changed.
Story number three, Chair.
Yeah. So Amtrak is selling a tracksuit. At least it was as of yesterday, and we're talking an actual outfit, two-piece outfit, right? It's a dark blue and white hooded sweatshirt. It zips up. It has matching pants. It's made of, quote, soft, cozy microfiber fleece, and it comes with a sleep mask, I guess, for long travel days. It has the Amtrak logo that on the chest and leg, and the cost, according to the Washington Post, was $279. $279. It was a limited release and only available through yesterday. Went on the website, no longer there. So you're probably asking, why in the world is Amtrak into fashion? Well, it was part of Amtrak's rollout of its next-gen Acela trains. Remember those new trains that came out? Well, they decided to hold a contest in collaboration with the New York School of Design to create an Amtrak-inspired tracksuit. And the Washington Post report that the suit sold out, you know, of its limited edition. And my reaction was, what in the what? Until I saw it. And let me tell you, it is kind of cool.
Gucci, Prada, Versace, Armani, none of them have made anything as beautiful as this Amtrak track suit.
And it looks so much better than wearing pajamas on the train.
That's not an opinion. That's just a fact. That's just a fact, Cherry. Look at how beautiful that thing is.
It's gorgeous.
If I could afford it, I would buy it in a second. You walk into a room
with that suit on,
with the Amtrak suit on.
Yeah.
You own that room.
Yeah.
That's your room.
It's a beautiful.
Look, it's a power move to have an Amtrak suit on.
It is. And
it's a beautiful little portmanteau right there. Amtrak suit.
And we weren't the only ones impressed. People online said, wow, holy swag.
We need more infrastructure branded swag. I want a Navy Yard hoodie. I want to.
They said Delta will probably have some Nike Air Ones.
I want Delta Nike Air Ones. I want it all. Yeah. I want it all. I want an I-95.
Well, you do like your SEPTA.
Boxers.
You
like, I want it all.
Avi already has a SEPTA sweatshirt, so he's always into
infrastructure. And guess what? It's my most complimented piece of apparel.
Because it's peach. Fact. It's a peach fact. Colored. You know, it's very gorgeous.
That's a fact.
Yes. Bring it back. All right. I like the suit. I would get it. I would get it, just so you know. But we're going to get serious.
Get serious, because today we're talking about gun ownership and politics. We want to ask you, have your views on gun ownership changed over the past 10 years? Give us a call or email. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
I'm Cherry Gregg. Today on the show, we're asking the question, is something changing about the debate over gun ownership in America? Following the DHS killing of Alex Pretty in Minnesota, the rhetoric on both sides of the political aisle was a bit scrambled.
On the Republican side, some leading figures made remarks that worry Second Amendment supporters. Here's a montage of Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia Jeanine Pirro, and FBI Director Kash Patel.
I don't know of any peaceful protester that shows up with a gun and ammunition rather than a sign.
I don't care if you have a license in another district, and I don't care if you're a law-abiding gun owner somewhere else. You bring a gun into this district, count on going to jail.
No one who wants to be peaceful shows up at a protest with a firearm that is loaded with two full magazines.
By contrast, Democrats, often in support of more gun control, came to Pretty's defense. And all of this is unfolding as anecdotal evidence suggests more liberals are buying guns and joining gun clubs.
So today we want to talk to gun owners and experts with different political viewpoints to understand what gun culture in 2026 is like and what has changed. So joining us now, we have James Reeves, executive producer of the Firearm Blog TV, and David Yamani, professor of sociology at Wake Forest University and author of Gun Curious, a liberal professor's surprising journey inside America's gun culture. James, David, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having us. I should have worn my Amtrak suit.
You can't get it. It's out
of
stock.
Limited edition.
I looked at it when you guys were talking about it at 404. like the website doesn't even work. So that's no Amtrak.
It's out. It's out of stock. We'll bring it back. Don't worry, James. We'll bring it back. Before we get going, we do have a question for all of you listening today. Have your views on gun ownership changed in the past 10 years? Why or why not? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, James, David, I want to sort of, before we get into the politics of it all, I want to start with something very basic. Sort of, what are you seeing in the groups you go to, you know, gun clubs, gun shops, gun culture research? What are you seeing on the ground? Are you seeing different types of folks sort of get into firearm culture that wouldn't have been part of this culture maybe 10 years ago? And James, we'll start with you.
Yeah, so one thing that I feel like I can give some additional perspective on is not just being involved in social media. I also do own a gun store. I'm a part owner of a gun store called the Neutral Ground Gun Company here in New Orleans. And we certainly are seeing, I would say, people typically outside of your gun owner demographic come in. And I think the statistics back that up as well. So, you know, me for one, I welcome it.
And so when you say outside of the typical gun demographic, give us an example. So is it more women? Is it more like, what are you seeing?
Yeah, females, minorities. I mean, because, of course, we can just say what we think. When people think of gun owner, they think of me, right? Like white guy, Southern white guy. And I think that we are seeing a disproportionate increase as per the norm. With a lot of minorities, you've got women coming in for more training. I do a women's only class from time to time. That's always well received. And again, I think it's a positive thing.
And so, David, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, just to back up what James said, you know, from 2020 forward, we don't have the most recent data, but certainly we saw in this great gun buying spree that happened during the COVID year, if you look at new gun owners in comparison to existing gun owners, right, and, you know, existing gun owners, you know, definitely kind of have a Duck Dynasty vibe to them, you know, older, white, southern, rural, conservative men. New gun owners from 2020 forward have been disproportionately female, racial minority. We don't have great data on sort of queer gun owners, but I think the anecdata supports what James said, which is that we do see an influx in gender queer and sexually queer gun owners or people interested in becoming gun owners. Wow. So that data, to the extent that we have it, definitely supports what James is seeing in his gun shop.
Let me bring in a caller. This is Lauren from Havertown on the line. Hey, Lauren, you're on Studio 2. Curious for your insights in this conversation.
Hi, thanks for letting me speak. I believe that on the left, they're seeing a dictatorship on the rise and illegal searches and seizures with ICE, who have full immunity to do what they want. And I don't think it's a part of the left's agenda to change what they view as gun ownership. I think it's a necessity because everything is being eroded by what I don't even call a president. I won't call him a president. They're arming themselves. They see the future. And our constitutional rights are being taken a piece at a time so that it's not really noticed. I think everybody should arm themselves now. And I am a Democrat and actually even worse, socialist. And I just don't see us being safe anymore. We have to be there. And you notice we say females, racial minorities, and whatever this guy means by queers, are arming themselves more. Well, that's why, because it's all of us.
All right. Thanks, Lauren. Thanks, Lauren.
Yep. Thank you.
Let's bring another caller. Here's Scarlett from Philadelphia, also wants to add 2 cents here. Scarlett, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective on this conversation?
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me. Yeah, so like I told the person doing my intake, I didn't really grow up in a gun household at all when I was young. Never really had to consider it. I grew up in a nice suburb, and, you know, kind of experiencing all of the political unrest in the 2020, like over that summer, really kind of opened my eyes to how it just really sucks out there. And, you know, that definitely led me to want to get my first firearm and learn how to do it myself. I'm very self-taught. I met a lot of good friends in the area who, you know, taught me the ropes. And, you know, 5 years later, I've made a career out of it. I work at a custom firearm shop in South Central PA. I teach other, you know, first-time queer gun owners, like, you know, the ropes, how to navigate everything, because it's, you know, like the last caller said, I mean, it's these incremental rights kind of being chipped away. And it's, you know, you live in this country, you get access to all the rights. And it's like something that I love seeing everyone partake in. Mm-hmm.
Scarlett, can I ask you a quick follow-up question before we let you go?
Yeah, of course.
You said it sucked out there, so you wanted to get a gun. What does that mean? And how would the gun help you in a world that you view as not as hostile in some way? Like, how does the gun help?
So it's you pose a really good question there, because a lot of people, when they hear like, oh, you know, I'm going to buy a gun for self-defense and maybe, you know, like for example, what happened with Alex Pretty, right? Like I fully believe he was not there to cause problems. And people may say, well, you know, if you bring a gun to a protest, what are you going to do? Blah, blah, blah. And it's not really for that. It's for all of the other, like, you know, moments of your life. Maybe you're, you know, walking home alone at night and you're afraid for your safety. Maybe you are trying to protect your family, right? And like, that's also the nice thing about the Second Amendment, right? It doesn't matter. And I feel like the more people that kind of understand that and appreciate that, I mean, we just become stronger as a community. Mm-hmm. You know, like most of my neighbors back home in Philly, they own guns and we all talk to each other. We all keep each other protected, watch out for each other. Thanks,
Scarlett. Appreciate the perspective.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'll just give the number again if you want to participate. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And our question of the day is, have your views on gun ownership changed in the last 10 years? Why or why not?
So we heard some perspectives there, David. I want to now get back to you. So we heard a couple folks saying basically they're looking at the political situation. They're looking at how safe they feel in their own neighborhood and saying, I need to own a gun. Do you think that explains the numbers that we're seeing that's politically motivated? And let me just add a little bit, because sometimes, look, we're in a bubble here where I think we talk to a lot of people who are super politically engaged. But, you know, when you're talking about big numbers changing, that means people who are maybe a little less politically engaged have to be somehow involved in this. And so it's like my little sprinkle of skepticism. Do you think it really is politics that is sort of creating the change that you feel like you've observed in the data?
I mean, I don't think we can divorce it from that, but I would like to give a little bit broader perspective as a sociologist. You know, I think that we need to understand that guns have been part of American society from the beginning, that they've been owned for defensive purposes from the beginning, that groups like African Americans and Native Americans have owned guns for collective security and protection against state violence, right? So some of these things are very old in American society. And so I think the only thing that's different now is the kind of inflection, right? That I would say that it's security and safety motivated, and that the security and safety motivations in recent years have been stimulated by concern about the Trump administration and whether that's going to be sort of state sanctioned violence or whether it's going to just be people motivated to engage in interpersonal violence by some of the sort of hateful rhetoric that oftentimes comes out of that administration. So, you know, I started hearing from trans gun owners or trans people interested in gun ownership before the 2024 election, certainly immediately following the 2024 election. And then when Trump issued an executive order that basically wrote trans people and other genderqueer people out of existence, then their sense that they were imperiled was sort of coming into being. So again, it's not surprising in that context, but I wouldn't want to reduce gun ownership simply to politics. It's really an issue of safety and security, and how people conceptualize their insecurities can vary from time and place.
Yeah. I want to bring in another caller. We have George from Trooper, PA on the line. George, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 78-year-old ex-Marine and a Vietnam veteran. When I came home from Vietnam, I really didn't want anything else to do with guns. But after watching what happened a couple of years ago, the attack on the Capitol, I'm very concerned that we're on the brink of a civil war, and I started buying guns again. I don't want to be the only one without a gun when the civil war breaks out.
Thank you. George from Trooper, Pennsylvania, on the line. And you know, James, I wanted to sort of walk through some of the reasons why people typically buy guns. I mean, because, you know, David talked about, you know, just made clear that it's not always politics. What are some of the other reasons that people typically buy guns? And is it different based on people's political affiliation from what you're seeing?
Well, I want to say, first of all, Lauren, Scarlett, welcome to the fold. Glad to have you. And again, I'm glad to get callers that are saying, look, I felt this way, now I felt that way, because now you understand what the Second Amendment is about. And I've been saying for decades, it's not a political issue, it's a fundamental right. And I think a lot of people are realizing that it's access to self-preservation, resistance to what someone may perceive as an oppressive government. Of course, one man's oppressive government is another man's ideal government. But that said, you have a whole host of reasons why people want to buy firearms. I mean, there's a rich sporting community. You have collectors. A lot of guns are fun to collect. There's a lot of history attached to them. But I would say that the overwhelming majority, and this is just my perspective based on what I've seen, you had kind of a couple of tranches of people who got involved in the gun community and bought guns. And I would say the big wave was during COVID. Views went up, sales went up. Everyone was interested because they realized, hey, look, this world can be a dangerous place. And I think it's a good idea maybe for me to have the ability to protect myself. So I'm seeing that overwhelmingly as the reason for it. But I mean, there, you know, look, at the end of the day, guns can be fun too.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at the long-term data, right, and you ask people, and this is all survey data, but it's different surveys, so I'll say it's not just one group. You ask folks, does someone in your house own a gun? Is there a gun owner living within your household? Over time, generally, if you track back to about the 60s when this stuff goes back to, the number has actually gone down. Little bump recently, if you look at Gallup or you look at the survey data of the University of Chicago. But over time, it has gone down. So I think there could be a question here, David, of whether what we think we're sort of witnessing here is kind of a blip, or it's a meaningful inflection point that's going to change the narrative around guns in this country. I'm curious for your perspective.
Yeah, you know, there are certainly some trends in American society, suburbanization, urbanization, the rise in female-headed households. You know, all of these things sort of drive down household gun ownership rates, but we have seen an increase recently. We don't know whether that's going to continue. And I think we also have to accept the fact that there is some systematic underreporting in who is going to answer a survey asking them whether they have guns in their household. And I know African Americans in Philadelphia, that I know something about from my research, are very unlikely to tell a pollster that they have a gun in their household, and for very good reason, not to mention, you know, sort of people who are skeptical of governments and universities generally. So, you know, there may have been some longer term secular trend toward declining rates of household gun ownership, but I think we're seeing a comeback, and that whatever comeback we're seeing also underrepresents the actual level of gun ownership. So, you know, we have a narrative now in our society with this shift toward more defensive orientation to guns, that those people who experience insecurity see guns as a viable option for them. And this does include a lot of people who in the past didn't see guns as a viable option for them.
Yeah, I want to read this comment. Thurston says, I'm politically independent, left-leaning, frequent voter. I'm registered as a Democrat, but I don't consider myself a Democrat. After leaving the Coast Guard and becoming a father in 2001, I did not want guns in my home or around my kids. I refused to even consider owning one. In 2020, during the pandemic, I decided that I needed a gun or two to protect my family. By 2024, noticing more and more diversity in the demographics of people becoming interested in firearms, I wanted to offer inclusive options and safe spaces for these new people to learn how to safely keep and bear. I now am a firearms instructor with the U.S. Concealed Carry Association. That's Thurston's story. And so I wondered, and I'm not sure, David or James, which of you could answer this question, but I just wonder, like David said, there's a lot of people. I have people in my family. I didn't even know they had a gun, right? And I'm like, oh, you have a gun? Oh, my goodness. Did not know. Do you think that part of it is people are coming out as gun owners possibly? Maybe they are finding community now, but they've had a gun or were, you know, left-leaning and had one, but never really wanted to express that they had it because of some of the politics of that. I just wonder, David, James, what do you think about that? Could that be part of the story as well?
I mean, I'll jump in real quickly, James, and I'm sure you've got some perspective on this also. But, you know, I, as a lifelong liberal who never saw, touched, or fired a gun until I was 42 years old and who lives most of my life in a university context, there is a strong stigma within liberal culture in the United States against guns, right? So I definitely had to steel myself and come out, so to speak, as a gun owner. And, you know, I still wonder what people think about me as a gun owner. So, you know, that's my experience. And I think a lot of people feel that, although decreasingly so as non-traditional gun owning becomes more publicly visible.
Yeah. Have you heard any of that, James? Like people wanting to, feeling like they're coming out as gun owners from a liberal perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I think that has led to this is you have communities online, like in particular, Reddit's a great example, Instagram, whatever. You've got social media where people, like-minded individuals, can congregate and they realize, hey, I'm not the only one. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's almost like a support system. I mean, this is funny using these terms like coming out and a support system for for gun ownership, but also to David's point in talking about the statistics of home ownership at the same time, while home ownership, gun owner rates have gone down, the raw number of guns has gone up significantly.
Right. It's about, somehow about how you slice the data. But we're going to get back into that conversation at the other side of this break. I want you both to stay there because you're giving us some great perspectives, David and James. Of course, if you're on the line, stay there. We want to get to your calls as well. 888-477-9499 is the number. The email is studio2@whyy.org asking you, have your views on gun ownership changed over the past 10 years? Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2 from WHYY.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today we're talking about the Venn diagram of gun ownership and political party affiliations and how it might be changing. I want to bring in a new voice into the conversation. Lara Smith is the national spokesperson for the Liberal Gun Club, an organization aimed at introducing new people to the culture of gun ownership and Second Amendment appreciation. Welcome, Lara.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so I'm curious how membership in your organization has been changing over the last few years or so. What insights can you give us into that?
Sure. We've been growing a lot. The growth started in 2016 with the first administration, but also with the Pulse nightclub shooting. But really, since the results of this election, we've seen just a huge, huge amount of growth, both in our membership, but also in our training requests. So we have a membership where you can come in. We have groups, we have a Discord, we have a place that people can talk, we have social events, but we also have a training arm where we train people who are new to gun ownership, who are coming in more from the left, a lot of times people who haven't had a background in firearms, and we can't keep up with the requests.
Yeah, well, give me a sense of the scale here. When you say it's grown a lot, is 10%, 20%, 30%?
Doubled, yeah.
Membership up about 25 to 30%. Training requests up 10 times.
Wow. So, you know, what type of training do you offer and what type of firearms are you seeing people being attracted to? And are they giving you reasons for this besides politics at all?
Right. So we mostly see people coming in for self-defense with handguns. Mm-hmm. But we do have a lot of people saying, hey, well, I want to learn how to stay safe in my home. I want a home defense gun. And that may be something different. We teach a fundamentals of firearms class, which will let people learn about firearms from, I'm really nervous. I've never done this. This seems very outside something I've ever thought I would do, to, oh, maybe I've done this before a couple times, but I want to get more proficient. We teach that class. We have what we call a make it safe class. So if someone in your home has a firearm, and you need to know how to unload it and make that firearm safe at any given time, we will teach you that. And then we also have a referral source to people who are instructors who teach people all across the political spectrum, but who are especially have cultural competency around the LGBTQIA community, around concerns, especially for people who are coming into firearms after a trauma, that kind of thing, people with disabilities. We have all those people that either are members or that we can refer people to.
Wow. I want to thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2. That was Lara Smith, a communications director and national spokesperson for the Liberal Gun Club. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
I want to bring in some more callers now because we have so many of them lined up.
Yeah.
And I want to bring in Annie from Winona, who is on line 3. Annie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I have a comment. And first, guns are meant to kill more faster. And what is changing is the truth is going to get out there. Guns are dangerous. They need to be heavily regulated. Right now, the right, they want more power, and they see it in their gun ownership and their rights. And the left, they want safety. They want less guns. We now know we have 45,000 gun deaths a year. 60 women a month are shot to death by a partner. We don't have enough regulations on either of those two. And a gun in the home is much more likely to kill or harm a family member than ever be used for defense. Mm. So let's bring the truth out.
Thank you, Annie. Thank Let me you. Bring in another perspective yeah. here. This is Emily from South mm-hmm. Philly, who's been waiting on the line for a while. Hey, Emily, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I kind of agree with the last caller in that, although I don't have a problem, if people want to own guns, that's their right. I do. I think hunting is great. I think all of that is, you know, shooting for fun is great. I don't feel safer having a gun. Mm-hmm. I feel less safe. I feel like, for example, it didn't help Alex Petty. It's Pretty, sorry. Mm-hmm. It didn't help Breonna Taylor. I think that a lot of times having a gun makes you more likely to get shot. It makes you more likely to mm-hmm. shoot somebody. So personally, I don't want one. I would yeah. rather just put my hands up and say, take whatever you want. Mm.
Thank you, yeah, Emily from South Philly, for that perspective. And David, let me put this to you now, because a lot of people are calling in and saying, I am buying a gun, or I'm interested in gun ownership because they want to feel safer. But, you know, there is data. I'll read this from Johns Hopkins University Review of the Literature. It's been well documented that firearm ownership rates are associated with increased firearm-related death rates among high-income countries. The U.S. is an outlier in terms of firearm violence. So the question, of course, then is, does perception match reality? And will, if this is indeed a trend and it continues, will it make all of us less safe? I'm curious for your perspectives as a sociologist, David.
Yeah, well, I think we can start by saying that, yes, guns are dangerous. If they weren't dangerous, they wouldn't be useful for the purposes that a lot of people have them for, including self-defense and hunting. So I don't shy away from that. But it does mean that we have to have a particular level of caution if you are going to become a gun owner. You know, you need to store your firearm safely. You need to make sure that people who are not authorized to access your firearms don't access them. And so, you know, I think that, again, we can slice this data pie in a lot of different ways. 45,000 gun deaths, including a disproportionate number of suicides, is, you know, quite terrible. But there are 80 million people who own over 400 million guns. Most of those people and guns are not problematic. And I think that's the part of this paradox that we have of guns, is that when guns are used inappropriately or fall into the wrong hands, they can be devastating. But that thankfully most gun owners are very responsible in their gun ownership and can be more responsible. And I think that the, you know, people in the gun community are working toward that.
James, I'm curious for your thoughts on this as well, responding to our callers.
Yeah, I want to thank Annie and Emily for calling in. Understandably, they're very passionate about the subject, so I don't want to dismiss that outright. But as we were talking about statistics, gun ownership is at an all-time high, while at the same time, you have gun violence, not gun deaths, which include, as we mentioned, a disproportionate number of suicides, but gun violence being at an all-time low. Now, certainly, if you could snap your fingers and every single gun in the world disappears, there will be no more gun violence. And that really becomes now a question of priority. Is it about trying to get rid of every single gun because you're trying to eliminate every source of gun violence or suicide, whatever the case may be, at the cost of a liberty that's enshrined in our Constitution?
Let me ask you about that too, because of course there's this, you know, repeated refrain that this is a necessity for, you know, counteracting tyranny or potential government tyranny. Mm-hmm. And I think some folks on the left just view that as like a fantasy, like really? I mean, if the American military wanted to crush you, it would crush you whether or not you have a few guns or not. I'm curious what the view is within the gun community on this idea that guns really are a bulwark against tyranny.
Well, to respond, twofold.
Yeah.
One, I always like the if the American government or the American military wanted to crush you, peasants who own firearms. We've seen in fairly recent history that that isn't a foregone conclusion, right? Secondarily, I think events recently, again, as I mentioned earlier, you have what is to some people an ideal government, an oasis of politics, is to other people an oppressive government. And I think that people traditionally on the other side of that debate, and I'll just say, you know, liberals, Democrats who are
typically left of center. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. They are now seeing that there is some value and hey, maybe a rule number two on this piece of paper actually might mean something and mean what people on the other side of the debate have been saying for decades.
Mm-hmm. By the way, in case you're just tuning in, I want to reintroduce our guests. That was the voice of James Reeves, executive producer of the Firearm Blog TV. We also have David Yamani, professor of sociology at Wake Forest University. I wanted to sort of talk about the politics a little bit because Pennsylvania Congressman Brendan Boyle posted on social media, I'm old enough to remember the Obama is going to grab your guns hysteria. Turns out it was the Trump White House. And I want to talk about the politics of this, David, because are liberals sort of like seizing on moments like this to argue about gun rights or to say, like, look, they're more fragile under, you know, Republican leadership than they would be under Democratic leadership. Do you see this as a moment for liberals and liberal gun owners specifically?
You know, I'm a lifelong Democrat, was vice president of the College Democrats when I was in school. I'm a card-carrying liberal. And, you know, I just don't, unfortunately, believe say Gavin Newsom is a Second Amendment advocate, that Kamala Harris, you know, that she had a gun and would shoot anybody who came into her house. I just can't take that seriously until the National Democratic Party and local Democratic parties embrace the right to own firearms more vigorously. You know, it's an opportunity right now for the National Democratic Party to do that and for local Democratic parties to do that and maybe be competitive in 26 and 28 elections. I'm not hopeful that's going to happen, but this is where there's a huge opportunity, and I wish the party would take it.
And I wanted to get your thoughts on that, James, as well, but also add a caveat, because from the right, you know, I remember the case of Philando Castile, a Black man who was armed legally and was shot and killed by police. Gun rights advocates did not necessarily come to his defense. You didn't necessarily, it was a delay in the Alex Pretty case. Do you think, you know, there are opportunities, missed opportunities, for the gun rights community to sort of step up. And if you believe in gun rights, that should be for every community, not just for some people. Your thoughts, James?
I completely agree with that. And I remember the Castile case. There's a lot of pressure put on the NRA to make a statement about it. And I think ultimately they did make a statement, but actually didn't use his name in that statement. So yeah, this is an opportunity. And what's frustrating to me is the hypocrisy from both sides. Because you have right now people, again, we say left of center or what have you, who are now saying, oh, well, you know, maybe gun rights aren't so bad. But what I worry about is the next time an administration gets into office, as David was saying, that chorus is going to change and everyone's going to forget about this. At the same time, on the right, you have exactly what you just mentioned, where one thing that was frustrating is like getting on Twitter. And if anyone looked at my Twitter feed over the past few days, arguing with people who were trying to pretextualize Alex Pretty's ownership of a gun and saying, like, for example, well, he didn't have a permit. And that's implying maybe he should have been shot even though he didn't have a permit. Well, how would anyone know he didn't have a permit? That's called a post hoc justification. For that matter, I think it's a little extreme to kill somebody because they didn't have a permit. So what I see is a lot of intellectual dishonesty. And that's what's frustrating to me, because it's very hard to make progress in this debate when we're being dishonest with each other. Just come out and say, I don't want this group of people to own guns. Just say it. But then at that point, now we're not talking about the Second Amendment anymore. We're talking about something else completely. And for that matter, I would add that something like I don't want this group of people to own guns is similar to maybe what redcoats would have said about those pesky colonists owning guns.
Yeah. Let me bring in some more callers. Some folks have been waiting. This is Damien from Doylestown on line two. Hey, Damien, you're on Studio Two. What's your question or comment?
Hey, I got a comment. I just want to first say thanks for taking my call. I live in Doylestown. I'm a liberal and I practice Buddhism. And yeah, I own a gun. Those things aren't opposites, no matter how much people want them to be. Buddhism has taught me restraint, awareness, and responsibility. It doesn't tell me to be naive or helpless. I don't carry out of fear or aggression. I carry because basically the world isn't perfect, and pretending otherwise is silly. So, you know, the gun isn't about dominance or violence for me. It's about last resort protection. I hope I never use it. I actively train my mind so I don't want to use it. That's the whole point. And I'd say, to me, Buddhism is about reducing suffering. Sometimes that means de-escalation and compassion. Sometimes it means being prepared so harm doesn't happen at all. I think both can coexist if you're disciplined and self-aware. So owning a gun doesn't make someone violent. Ego, rage, irresponsibility do. And a weapon in the hands of someone who practices restraint is safer than a, you know, a fist of an angry person.
Yeah. Thanks, Damien.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thanks for taking my call, guys.
And interesting call.
Listener. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I would say one of a kind call there from Damien. Yeah. Here's Danielle from Doylestown. Let's just pair the Doylestown people here together. Danielle's on line five. Danielle, we're getting toward the end of this hour, but curious for your perspective on this conversation.
Hi, I actually grew up in rural Pennsylvania. Guns in the household, learned to shoot a handgun at 10 years old. I lived in Pennsylvania, West Philly, Colorado, New York. And the safest I ever felt was when I lived in the UK, where people just did not have access to guns. I feel a lot of people who want guns are thinking that if they buy it, it's automatic safety, when really is a self-defense class, a whistle, and more alarms around your house actually going to make you feel safer. I feel on the left here, we are throwing the baby out with the bathwater and just giving into it, when stricter gun laws are going to keep us safer. Having a gun in the house is going to lead to more damage. And a New York Times article even said the more you shoot a gun, it does damage to your brain in the long run. So even gun safety is hurting us.
Thank you, Danielle. Two interesting calls there.
And I wonder, you know, can someone be, and I want to talk about this whole balance of being someone who is very, you know, pro gun control, meaning background checks, waiting periods, limits on where you can carry, and how you balance that, David, with being someone who is very much pro Second Amendment and the right to have a firearm. How do you balance? How do you thread that needle where you can be someone who is very liberal, very much about gun control, but very much about gun rights?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, my friend, gun educator Rob Pincus says it's best, which is that rights entail responsibilities. And, you know, very few people in the gun rights movement are talking about just unfettered rights and without some level of responsibility to go along with gun ownership. And I feel like this dichotomy that we often create between gun rights and public safety, and saying that you can't have one without the other, is just a false choice. I think we need to engage in a lot more both and thinking about guns, and recognize, you know, the harm that they do, and also, you know, the good that they do, and also the fact that a lot of them just don't do either, right? They're just part of people's everyday lives.
I think the reason a lot of people view it as a choice, David, is that they look at countries where gun ownership is much more difficult to achieve, where gun ownership rates are much lower, and they say, look, these are safer places to live. And it's just very difficult to have a society where lots of people own guns, and, you know, you have sort of gun death rates, or just violence rates, lethal violence rates, on par with what we want. I mean, how do you actually have both and, David?
Well, I think you recognize that, you know, there is an element of danger involved in the idea of freedom. To James's earlier point, we're not ever going to have a situation in which there are no firearms in the world. We've just, as a society, we've made a choice to decentralize ownership of firearms, whereas other countries have decided to centralize ownership of firearms. And, you know, I think that from my perspective, it's much more worrisome to have that centralized ownership of lethal violence, even though, you know, we recognize that lots of our freedoms in this society come, you know, with some danger.
Real quick, James.
Alcohol use, driving cars, and so on.
Real quick, James, we're only about 30 seconds left, but I sense something when you said earlier that there's hypocrisy on both sides, that you think this debate eventually will snap back to its normal dimensions. Do you believe that, or do you think this is maybe an inflection point where we could really see the gun debate morph into something new?
I'm pessimistic, but I aspire to exactly what you just mentioned. I hope that this changed the dynamic. And these trends are going to impact the political discourse over this issue, but I'm not optimistic.
Yeah. Well, look, I really appreciate you both being here today and having this conversation with us. And I also want to thank our callers who were just fantastic today.
Amazing
and it
callers.
It makes the show so much more lively and interesting and revelatory. So thank you to them. And thank you to you, James Reeves, executive producer of the Firearm Blog TV. Thanks, James, for your time today.
Thank you, guys.
Equal thanks to David Yamani, professor of sociology at Wake Forest University and author of Gun Curious, a liberal professor's surprising journey inside America's gun culture. David, thanks for the time.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And thanks to everybody who wrote in. We got a lot of folks who wrote in comments as well. And for folks on YouTube, I saw a lot going back and forth in the comments section. We appreciate you as well. And thanks, of course, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calliquet engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.